No interference. Hidden fees. Discount brokers may shout about their lower commissions, but commissions aren't their only way of making money. Many discount brokers charge extra for services that you may think are included, such as issuing a stock certificate or mailing a statement. Ask whether they assess fees for maintaining IRAs, or fees for transferring stocks and other securities, such as bonds, in or out of your account, and find out what interest rates they charge for borrowing through brokerage accounts. Minimal customer service. If you deal with an internet brokerage firm, find out about its customer service capability. If you can't transact business at its website, find out where you can call for assistance with your order. When it's time to choose a broker, keep the following points in mind. Match your investment style with a brokerage firm that charges the least amount of money for the services you're likely to use most frequently. Compare all the costs of buying, selling, and holding stocks and other securities through a broker. Don't compare only commissions. Compare other costs, too, such as margin interest and other service charges. Use broker comparison services, such as Gomez Advisors, at www.gomez.com, and read articles that compare brokers in publications such as Smart Money and Barron's. What's the number one reason people invest in stocks? To grow their wealth, also referred to as capital appreciation. People interested in growing their wealth see stocks as one of the convenient ways to do it. Growth stocks tend to be riskier than other categories of stocks, but they offer excellent long-term prospects for making the big bucks. If you don't believe me, then just ask Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch, and other successful investors. Although someone like Warren Buffett is not considered a growth investor, his long-term, value-oriented approach has been a successful growth strategy. If you're the type of investor who has enough time to let somewhat risky stocks trend upward, or who has enough money so that a loss won't devastate you financially, then growth stocks are definitely for you. As they say, no guts, no glory. The challenge is to figure out which stocks will make you richer quicker. Short of starting your own business, stock investing is the best way to profit from a business venture. I want to emphasize that to make money in stocks consistently over the long haul, you must remember that you're investing in a company. Buying the stock is just a means for you to participate in the company's success or failure. What does it matter that you think of stock investing as buying a company versus buying a stock? Invest in a stock only if you're just as excited about it as you would be if you were the CEO and in charge of running the company. If you're the sole owner of the company, do you act differently than one of a legion of obscure stockholders? Of course you do. As the owner of the company, you have a greater interest in the company. You have a strong desire to know how the enterprise is doing. As you invest in stocks, make believe that you're the owner and take an active interest in the company's products, services, sales, earnings, and so on. This attitude and discipline can enhance your goals as a stock investor. This approach is especially important if your investment goal is growth. Basically, a growth stock performs better than its peers in categories such as sales and earnings. Value stocks are stocks that are priced lower than the value of the company and its assets. You can identify a value stock by analyzing the company's fundamentals and looking at key financial ratios, such as the price-to-earnings ratio. Growth stocks tend to have better prospects for growth for the immediate future, from 1 to 4 years, but value stocks tend to have less risk and more steady growth over a longer term. Over the years, a debate has quietly raged in the financial community about growth versus value investing. Some people believe that growth and value are mutually exclusive. They maintain that large numbers of people buying stock with growth as the expectation tend to drive up the stock price relative to the company's current value. Growth investors, for example, aren't put off by price-to-earnings, PE, ratios of 30, 40, or higher. Value investors, meanwhile, are too nervous buying a stock at those PE ratio levels. However, you can have both. A value-oriented approach to growth investing serves you best. Long-term growth stock investors spend time analyzing the company's fundamentals to make sure that the company's growth prospects lie on a solid foundation. But what if you have to choose between a growth stock and a value stock? Which do you choose? Seek value when you are buying the stock and analyze the company's prospects for growth. Growth includes, but is not limited to, the health and growth of the company's specific industry and the economy at large. The bottom line is that growth is much easier to achieve when you seek solid, value-oriented companies in growing industries. When choosing growth stocks, you should consider investing in a company only if it makes a profit, and if you understand how it makes that profit, and from where it generates sales. Part of your research means looking at the industry and economic trends in general. You have to measure the growth of a company against something to figure out whether it's a growth stock. Usually, you compare the growth of a company with growth from other companies in the same industry or with the stock market in general. In practical terms, when you measure the growth of a stock against the stock market, you're actually comparing it against a generally accepted benchmark, such as the Dow Jones Industrial Average, DJIA, or the Standard & Poor's 500, S&P 500. If a company has earnings growth of 15% per year over 3 years or more, and the industry's average growth rate over the same time frame is 10%, then this stock qualifies as a growth stock. A growth stock is called that not only because the company is growing, but also because the company is performing well with some consistency. Having a single year where your earnings do well versus the S&P 500's average doesn't cut it. Growth must be consistently accomplished. When you hear the word fundamentals in the world of stock investing, it refers to the company's financial condition and related data. When investors, especially value investors, do fundamental analysis, they look at the company's fundamentals, its balance sheet, income statement, cash flow, and other operational data, along with external factors such as the company's market position, industry, and economic prospects. Essentially, the fundamentals indicate the company's financial condition. The main numbers you want to look at include the following. Sales. Are the company's sales this year surpassing last year's? As a decent benchmark, you want to see sales at least 10% higher than last year. Although it may differ depending on the industry, 10% is a reasonable general yardstick. Earnings. Are earnings at least 10% higher than last year? Earnings should grow at the same rate as sales, or hopefully better. Debt. Is the company's total debt equal to or lower than the prior year? The death knell of many a company has been excessive debt. A company's financial condition has more factors than I mention here, but these numbers are the most important. I also realize that using the 10% figure may seem like an oversimplification, but you don't need to complicate matters unnecessarily. I know someone's computerized financial model may come out to 9.675%, or maybe 11.07%, but keep it simple for now. A strong company in a growing industry is a common recipe for success. If you look at the history of stock investing, this point comes up constantly. Investors need to be on the alert for megatrends because they help ensure your success. What is a megatrend? A megatrend is a major development that has huge implications for much, if not all, of society for a long time to come. Good examples are the advent of the Internet and the aging of America. Both of these trends offer significant challenges and opportunities for our economy. Take the Internet, for example. Its potential for economic application is still being developed. Millions are flocking to it, for many reasons. And census data tells us that senior citizens, over 65, will be the fastest growing segment of our population during the next 20 years. How does the stock investor take advantage of a megatrend? In the wake of the 2000 to 2002 stock bear market, two megatrends hit their stride: rising energy prices and an overheated housing market. As of 2005, these two issues became major news items with tremendous ripple effects across the national economy. For the growth investor, strategy became clear: find value-oriented companies with solid fundamentals that are well-positioned to benefit from these megatrends. What's the result? From 2002 to 2005, many energy-related and housing-related stocks skyrocketed. as oil surpassed $65 a barrel and gasoline hit $3 a gallon, most oil and oil services companies saw their stocks go up 50%, 100%, and more during that three-year time frame. Housing stocks were even more impressive. In addition, companies that catered to these industries also prospered. Mortgage firms that were publicly traded also posted impressive gains. Companies that have established a strong niche are consistently profitable. Look for a company with one or more of the following characteristics. A strong brand. Companies such as Coca-Cola and Microsoft come to mind. Yes, other companies out there can make soda or software, but a business needs a lot more than a similar product to topple companies that have established an almost irrevocable identity with the public. High barriers to entry. United Parcel Service and Federal Express have set up tremendous distribution and delivery networks that competitors can't easily duplicate. High barriers to entry offer an important edge to companies that are already established. Research and development, R&D. Companies such as Pfizer and Merck spend a lot of money researching and developing new pharmaceutical products. This investment becomes a new product with millions of consumers who become loyal purchasers, so the company is going to grow. You can invest in a great company and still see its stock go nowhere. Why? Because what makes the stock go up is demand, having more buyers than sellers of the stock. If you pick a stock for all the right reasons, and the market notices the stock as well, that attention causes the stock price to climb. The things to watch for include the following. Institutional buying. Are mutual funds and pension plans buying up the stock you're looking at? If so, this type of buying power can exert tremendous upward pressure on the stock's price. Some resources and publications track institutional buying and how that affects any particular stock. Frequently, when a mutual fund buys a stock, others soon follow. In spite of all the talk about independent research, a herd mentality still exists. Analysts' attention. Are analysts talking about the stock on the financial shows? As much as you should be skeptical about an analyst's recommendation, given the stock market debacle of 2000 to 2002, it offers some positive reinforcement for your stock. Don't ever buy a stock solely on the basis of an analyst's recommendation. Just know that if you buy a stock based on your own research and analysts subsequently rave about it, your stock price is likely to go up. A single recommendation by an influential analyst can be enough to send a stock skyward. Newsletter recommendations. Independent researchers usually publish newsletters. If influential newsletters are touting your choice, that praise is also good for your stock. Although some great newsletters are out there, and they offer information that's as good or better than the research departments of some brokerage firms, don't use a single tip to base your investment decision on. But it should make you feel good if the newsletters tout a stock that you've already chosen. Consumer publications. No, you won't find investment advice here. This one seems to come out of left field, but it's a source that you should notice. Publications such as Consumer Reports regularly look at products and services and rate them for consumer satisfaction. If a company's offerings are well received by consumers, that's a strong positive for the company. This kind of attention ultimately has a positive effect on that company's stock. A growth stock isn't a creature like the Loch Ness Monster, always talked about but rarely seen. Growth stocks have been part of the financial scene for nearly a century. Examples abound that offer rich information that you can apply to today's stock market environment. Look at past market winners, especially those of the 1970s and 1980s, and ask yourself, what made them profitable stocks? I mention these two decades because they offer a stark contrast to one another. The 70s were a tough, bearish decade for stocks, while the 80s were booming bull times. Being aware and acting logically are as vital to successful stock investing as they are to any other pursuit. Over and over again, history gives you the formula for successful stock investing. Pick a company that has strong fundamentals, including signs such as rising sales and earnings and low debt. Make sure that the company is in a growing industry. Be fully invested in stocks during a bull market when prices are rising in the stock market and in the general economy. During a bear market, switch more of your money out of growth stocks, such as technology, and into defensive stocks, such as utilities. Monitor your stocks. Hold on to stocks that continue to grow, and sell those stocks that are declining. The management of a company is crucial to its success. Before you buy stock in a company, you want to know that the company's management is doing a great job. But how do you do that? If you call up a company and ask, it may not even return your phone call. How do you know whether management is running the company properly? The best way is to check the numbers. If the company's management is running the business well, the ultimate result is a rising stock price. Although you can measure how well management is doing in several ways, you can take a quick snapshot of a management team's competence by checking the company's return on equity, ROE. You calculate the ROE simply by dividing earnings by equity. The resulting percentage gives you a good idea whether the company is using its equity or net assets efficiently and profitably. Basically, the higher the percentage, the better. But you can consider the ROE solid if the percentage is 10% or higher. Keep in mind that not all industries have identical ROEs. To find out a company's earnings, check out the company's income statement. The income statement is a simple financial statement that expresses the equation sales less expenses equal net earnings, or net income or net profit. To find out a company's equity, check out that company's balance sheet. The balance sheet is actually a simple financial statement that illustrates total assets minus total liabilities equal net equity. For public stock companies, the net assets are called shareholders' equity, or simply equity. Two additional barometers of success are a company's growth in earnings and growth of equity. Watching management as it manages the business is important, but another indicator of how well the company is doing is to see whether management is buying stock in the company as well. If a company is poised for growth, who knows better than management? And if management is buying up the company's stock en masse, then that's a great indicator of the stock's potential. A company's financial situation does change, and you, as a diligent investor, need to continue to look at the numbers for as long as the stock is in your portfolio. You may have chosen a great stock from a great company with great numbers in 2003, but chances are pretty good that the numbers have changed since then. Great stocks don't always stay that way. A great selection that you're drawn to today may become tomorrow's pariah. Information, both good and bad, moves like lightning. In late 2000, analysts considered Enron a cream-of-the-crop stock, and they fell over themselves extolling its virtues. Even the then-celebrated market strategist, Abby Joseph Cohen, called Enron her number one choice in the energy sector as late as September 2001. Yet Enron shocked investors when it filed for bankruptcy in December 2001. Its stock price fell from $84 in December 2000 to a staggering 26 cents a share, yikes, in October 2001. Keep an eye on your stock company's numbers. I become a Johnny One Note on one topic, trailing stops. Trailing stops are stop losses that you regularly manage with the stock you invest in. I always advocate using them, especially if you're new to the game of buying growth stocks. Trailing stops can help you no matter how good or bad the economy is, or how good or bad the stock you're investing in is. Suppose that you had invested in Enron, a classic example of a phenomenal growth stock that went bad. In 1999 and 2000, when its stock soared, investors were as happy as chocoholics at Hershey. Along with many investors who forgot that sound investing takes discipline and research, Enron investors thought, downside risk? What downside risk? Here's an example of how a stop-loss order would have worked if you had invested in Enron. Suppose that you bought Enron in 2000 at $50 per share and put in a stop-loss order with your broker at $45. Remember to make it a GTC, or good till canceled order. If you do, the stop-loss order stays on indefinitely. As a general rule, I like to place the stop-loss order at 10% below the market value. As the stock went up, you kept the stop-loss trailing upward, like a tail. Now you know why it's called a trailing stop. It trails the stock's price. When Enron hit $70, your stop loss was changed to, say, $63, and so on. At $84, your new stop loss was at $76. Then what? When Enron started its perilous descent, you got out at $76. The new price of $76 triggered the stop loss, and the stock was automatically sold. You stopped the loss. Actually, in this case, you could call it a stop and cash in the gain order. Because you bought the stock at $50 and sold at $76, you pocketed a nice capital gain of $26. Then you safely stepped aside and watched the stock continue its plunge. But what if the market is doing well? Are trailing stops a good idea? Because these stops are placed below the stock price, you're not stopping the stock from rising upward indefinitely. All you're doing is protecting your investment from loss. That's discipline. The stock market of 2004 to 2005 was fairly good to stock investors, as the bear market that started in 2000 took a break. If a bear market continues, trailing stop strategies will again become very useful, because a potential decline in the stock price will become a greater risk. Everyone wants to get in early on a hot new stock. Why not? You buy Schlumberger Inc. at $1 per share and hope it zooms to $98 before lunchtime. Who doesn't want to buy a stock that could become the next IBM or Microsoft? This possibility is why investors are attracted to small-cap stocks. Small cap, or small capitalization, is a reference to the company's market size. Small-cap stocks are stocks that have a market value under $1 billion. Investors may face more risk with small caps, but they also have the chance for greater gains. Out of all the types of stocks, small-cap stocks continue to exhibit the greatest amount of growth. In the same way that a tree planted last year has more opportunity for growth than a mature 100-year-old redwood, small caps have greater growth potential than established large-cap stocks. Of course, a small cap doesn't exhibit spectacular growth just because it's small. It grows when it does the right things, such as increasing sales and earnings by producing goods and services that customers want. For every small company that becomes a Fortune 500 firm, hundreds of companies don't grow at all or go out of business. When you try to guess the next great stock before any evidence of growth, you're not investing. You're speculating. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with speculating, but it's important to know that you're speculating when you're doing it. When a company goes public, it means that it undergoes an initial public offering, IPO. The IPO is the process by which a private firm seeks the assistance of an investment banking firm to gain financing by issuing stock that the public purchases. IPOs generate a lot of excitement, and many investors consider the IPO to be that proverbial ground floor opportunity. After all, some people find it appealing to get a stock before its price skyrockets after investors subsequently flock to it. Why wouldn't people find IPOs appealing? Well, IPOs actually have a poor track record of success in their first year. Studies periodically done by the brokerage industry have revealed that IPOs, more times than not, actually decline in price during the first 12 months, 60% of the time. In other words, an IPO has a better than even chance of dropping in price. The lesson for investors is that they're better off waiting to see how the stock and the company perform. Don't worry about missing that great opportunity. If it's a bona fide opportunity, you'll still do well after the IPO. Because a company's going public is frequently an unproven enterprise, investing in an IPO can be risky. Here are the two types of IPOs. Startup IPO. This is a company that didn't exist before the IPO. In other words, the entrepreneurs get together and create a business plan. To get the financing they need for the company, they decide to go public immediately by approaching an investment banker. If the investment banker thinks that it's a good concept, the banker will seek funding, selling the stock to investors via the IPO. A private company that decides to go public. In many cases, the IPO is done for a company that already exists and is seeking expansion capital. The company may have been around for a long time as a smaller private concern, but it decides to seek funding through an IPO to grow even larger or to fund a new product, promotional expenses, and so on. Which of the two IPOs do you think is less risky? That's right, the private company going public. Why? Because it's already a proven business, which is a safer bet than a brand new startup. Some great examples of successful IPOs in recent years are United Parcel Service and Google. They were both established companies before they went public. Great stocks started as small companies going public. You may be able to recount the stories of Federal Express, Dell, AOL, Home Depot, and hundreds of other great successes. But do you remember an IPO by the company Lipschitz & Farquhar? No? I didn't think so. It's among the majority of IPOs that don't succeed. For investors, the lesson is clear. Wait until a track record appears before you invest in a company. If you don't, you're simply rolling the dice. In other words, you're speculating, not investing. I emphasize two points when investing in stocks. Make sure that a company is established. Being in business for at least 3 years is a good minimum. Make sure that a company is profitable. These points are especially important for investors in small stocks. Plenty of startup ventures lose money, but hope to make a fortune down the road. A good example is a company in the biotechnology industry. Biotech is an exciting area, but it's esoteric, and at this early stage, companies are finding it difficult to use the technology in profitable ways. You may say, but shouldn't I jump in now, in anticipation of future profits? You may get lucky, but understand that when you invest in unproven small-cap stocks, you're speculating. The only difference between a small-cap stock and a large-cap stock is a few zeros in their numbers, and the fact that you need to do more research with small caps. By sheer dint of size, small caps are riskier than large caps, so you offset the risk by accruing more information on the stock in question. Plenty of information is available on large-cap stocks because they're widely followed. Small-cap stocks don't get as much press, and fewer analysts issue reports on them. Here are a few points to keep in mind. Understand your investment style. Small-cap stocks may have more potential rewards, but they also carry more risk. No investor should devote a large portion of his capital to small-cap stocks. If you're considering retirement money, you're better off investing in large-cap stocks, exchange-traded funds, ETFs, investment-grade bonds, bank accounts, and mutual funds. For example, retirement money should be in investments that are either very safe or have proven track records of steady growth over an extended period of time, 5 years or longer. Check with the SEC. Get the financial reports that the company must file with the SEC. These reports offer more complete information on the company's activities and finances. Check other sources. See whether brokers and independent research services, such as Valueline, follow the stock. If two or more different sources like the stock, it's worth further investigation. Investing for income means investing in stocks that provide you with regular money payments, dividends. Income stocks may not offer stellar growth, but they're good for a steady infusion of money. What type of person is best suited to income stocks? Income stocks can be appropriate for many investors, but they're especially well suited for the following individuals. Conservative and novice investors. Conservative investors like to see a slow but steady approach to growing their money while getting regular dividend checks. Novice investors who want to start slowly also benefit from income stocks. Retirees. Growth investing is best suited for long-term needs, while income investing is best suited to current needs. Retirees may want some growth in their portfolios, but they're more concerned with regular income that can keep pace with inflation. Dividend Reinvestment Plan, DRP, investors. For those investors who like to compound their money with DRPs, income stocks are perfect. If you have a low tolerance for risk, or if your investment goal is anything less than long-term, income stocks are your best bet. Getting your stock portfolio to yield more income is easier than you think. Many income investors increase income using proven techniques such as covered call writing. Covered call writing is an option strategy that is covered more fully in sources such as the book Stock Options for Dummies, published by Wiley. You can also find great educational material on this option strategy and many others at places such as the Chicago Board Options Exchange, www.cboe.com. When people talk about gaining income from stocks, they're usually talking about dividends. A dividend is nothing more than money paid out to the owner of stock. You purchase dividend stocks primarily for income, not for spectacular growth potential. A dividend is quoted as an annual number, but is usually paid on a quarterly basis. A good income stock is a stock that has a higher than average dividend, typically 4% or higher. Dividend rates aren't guaranteed. They can go up or down, or in some extreme cases, the dividend can be discontinued. Fortunately, most companies that issue dividends continue them indefinitely and actually increase dividend payments from time to time. Historically, dividend increases have equaled or exceeded the rate of inflation. Income stocks tend to be among the least volatile of all stocks, and many investors view them as defensive stocks. Defensive stocks are stocks of companies that sell goods and services that are generally needed, no matter what shape the economy is in. Don't confuse defensive stocks with defense stocks, which specialize in goods and equipment for the military. Food, beverage, and utility companies are great examples of defensive stocks. Even when the economy is experiencing tough times, people still need to eat, drink, and turn the lights on. Companies that offer relatively high dividends also tend to be large firms in established, stable industries. Some industries in particular are known for high dividend stocks. Utilities, such as electric, gas, and water. Real estate investment trusts, REITs. And the energy sector, oil and gas, are places where you definitely find income stocks. Yes, you can find high dividend stocks in other industries, but you find a high concentration of them in these industries. Before you say, "Income stocks are great, I'll get my checkbook and buy a batch right now," take a look at some potential disadvantages. Income stocks do come with some fine print. Income stocks can go down as well as up, just as any stock can. Obviously, you don't mind your income stock going up in value, but it can go down just as easily. The factors that affect stocks in general, politics, economic trends, industry changes, and so on, affect income stocks too. Fortunately, income stocks don't get hit as hard as other stocks when the market is declining, because high dividends tend to act as a support to the stock price. Therefore, income stocks' prices usually fall less dramatically than the prices of other stocks in a declining market. Income stocks can be sensitive to rising interest rates. When interest rates go up, other investments, such as corporate bonds, U.S. Treasury securities, and bank certificates of deposit, are more attractive. When your income stock is yielding 4% and interest rates are going to 5%, 6%, or higher, you may think, why settle for a 4% yield when I can get 5% or better elsewhere? As more and more investors sell their low-yield stock, the prices for those stocks fall. Another point to remember is that rising interest rates may hurt the company's financial strength. If the company has to pay more interest, that may affect the company's earnings, which in turn may affect the dividend. Dividend-paying companies that are experiencing consistent, falling revenues tend to cut dividends. In this case, consistent means beyond just a year. Although many companies raise their dividends on a regular basis, some don't. Or, if they do raise their dividends, the increases may be small. If income is your primary consideration, you want to be aware of this fact. If you're getting the same dividend year after year, and this income is important to you, rising inflation becomes a problem. Inflation shrinks the value of the dividend income you receive. If you're an investor seeking income and you're very nervous about potential risks with income stocks, here are some non-stock alternatives. U.S. Treasury securities. Issued by the federal government, these securities are considered the safest investments in the world. Examples of Treasury securities are U.S. savings bonds and Treasury bonds. They pay interest and are an ideal addition to any income investor's portfolio. Bank certificates of deposit, CDs. These investments are backed up by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, and are considered very safe. Income mutual funds. Many mutual funds, such as treasury bond mutual funds and corporate bond funds, are designed for income investors. They offer investors diversification and professional management, and investors can usually invest with as little as $1,000. The government usually taxes dividends as ordinary income. Fortunately, recent tax legislation has favored dividend-paying stock. Look at income stocks in the same way you do growth stocks when assessing the financial strength of a company. Getting nice dividends comes to a screeching halt if the company can't afford to pay them. If your budget depends on dividend income, then monitoring the company's financial strength is that much more important. If you're certain that you want income stocks, do a rough calculation to figure out how big a portion of your portfolio you want income stocks to occupy. If you have income stocks and don't have any immediate need for the dividends, consider reinvesting the dividends in the company's stock. Every investor is different. If you're not sure about your current or future needs, your best choice is to consult with a financial planner. Don't stop scrutinizing stocks after you acquire them. You may have made a great choice that gives you a great dividend, but that doesn't mean that the stock stays that way indefinitely. Monitor the company's progress for as long as it's in your portfolio. When a company suffers significant financial difficulties, its ability to pay dividends is compromised. So, if you need dividend income to help you pay your bills, you better be aware of the dividend payout ratio. Generally, a dividend payout ratio of 60% or less is safe. Obviously, the lower the percentage is, the safer the dividend. Yes, you can do your own research. And you want to, don't you? But I may as well make you privy to what my research tells me are the unfolding megatrends that offer the greatest potential rewards for stock investors. Only a handful of changes in your portfolio over the past 4 decades would have made you tremendously rich. Had you put your money into natural resources, such as gold, silver, and oil, at the beginning of the 1970s, and stayed put until the end of the decade, you would have made a fortune. Then, had you cashed in and switched to Japanese stocks in 1980 and held them for the rest of the decade, you would have made another fortune. Then, had you switched in 1990 to U.S. stocks for the entire decade, you would have made yet another fortune. What if you had cashed in your stocks in 2000? Well, for starters, you would have avoided huge losses in the bear market. How about being bullish? What looks like a strong bull market for this decade? By and large, this decade seems to be a repeat of the 70s. The general realm of natural resources looks to be the primary bull market for this decade. Why? First, look at what this decade has in common with the 70s. Problems with energy, rising costs, supply disruptions, and so on. Rising inflation, as the dollar loses value versus other currencies. International conflict, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, and so on. Sluggish domestic economy. Rising prices for natural resources, grains, metals, lumber, and so on. However, this decade has more to consider, including the following. Debt, debt, and more debt. $43 trillion as of July 2005. 3.5 times the U.S. GDP total of $12 trillion. The U.S. as a major importer versus being an exporter in the 70s. China and India as major economic competitors. Terrorism affecting the U.S. within its borders. $372 trillion worth of derivatives, 9 times larger than the world's total GDP. Much of these derivatives are very arcane and risky. Social Security and Medicare liabilities. Rising costs start in 2008 as the oldest baby boomers start to retire. This list isn't comprehensive, but the information I've already cited is enough to make you understand that this investing environment has changed dramatically, and you need to refocus your overall game plan to keep your money growing. By the way, you'll see 2 types of opportunities here, bullish and bearish. If I can't help you find the winning stocks, then by golly, I can show you what losers to stay away from. Being bullish or going long is the natural inclination for most investors. It's an easy concept. Buy low, sell high. No rocket science there. What will have a mega impact on the world can be boiled down to two words, China and India. In the past 10 years, these two countries have put their economies on the fast track. Consider the following. They have generally turned away from socialism and a command economy, and have instead turned to a free market or more capitalistic system. Industrialization, privatization, and profit incentives have ignited tremendous booms in those countries. Both countries' populations have continued to grow. China has about 1.5 billion people, while India recently surpassed 1 billion. What do these facts mean for stock investors? Somebody's got to sell them what they need. China, for example, has a voracious appetite for natural resources such as building materials, energy, copper, grain, and so on. Companies that have provided the goods and services needed do very well. Phelps Dodge Corp., for example, produces copper and other materials and base metals necessary for industry. In early 2003, its share price was under $30. By August 2005, it was at $110, up a sizzling 266%. Compare that performance against a benchmark such as the S&P 500. During the same time frame, the S&P 500 was basically flat. Another great example is Archer Daniels Midland Company. It processes and merchandises agricultural commodities and products. In early 2003, you could have bought its stock for about $10 per share. By the summer of 2005, it hit $22, an increase of 120%. While many investors saw their portfolios go up a little, down a little, or flatline, resource investors saw their stocks do very well. Of course, China and India are only a part of the world's emerging markets, but they're certainly the most important to Americans in terms of economic impact. They are indeed megatrends that will either help or hurt your portfolio. In the coming years, demand will likely continue to be strong, and investors will see the obvious positive implications for solid companies that meet this demand. Recent headlines tell me that the costs of energy are a major challenge for the economy. For decades, U.S. society has benefited from cheap oil, but global supply and demand, among other things, has caught up with us. A gallon of gas has undergone a meteoric rise. A major news item has been the condition called peak oil. Energy investors must become familiar with this condition because it has, and will, weigh very heavily on the economy because people are so dependent on oil for their modern lifestyle. The days of cheap oil are now history. Higher energy prices will affect all stocks. If you're going to pay more for energy, then you may as well benefit. The bottom line is that stock investors will either have to consider energy in their investment strategies or risk having energy prices steamroll over their potential gains. Investment opportunities are plentiful in companies that provide, sell, distribute, or explore energy. But you may want to consider energy alternatives as well. America and the world will be forced to turn to alternative energy sources in the coming years. As conventional oil and gas become scarce, America will look into gaining energy from sources such as Canada's oil sands, and also to sources such as wind, solar, and fuel cell technologies, among others. As you listen, you may not be sure about what particular company you should invest in. If that's the case, why not consider a convenient way to invest in an entire industry or sector? A good consideration is an exchange-traded fund, ETF. An ETF is like buying a whole portfolio of stocks as if it were a single stock. An example is an ETF with the symbol XLE. XLE has a cross-section of the largest public oil and gas companies, such as ExxonMobil, Chevron, and others. In 2003, I bought this XLE for $18 per share. By August 2005, it hit $50. To find out more about ETFs, go to the American Stock Exchange, www.amex.com, for all the details. I'm sure that you've heard much about the graying of America. This phrase obviously represents a firm megatrend in place. For stock investors, this megatrend is a purely demographic play, and the numbers are with you. The number of people who are over the age of 50, and especially those considered senior citizens, are the fastest growing segment of American society. The same megatrend is in place in all corners of the world, especially Europe. As more and more people get into this category, the idea that companies that serve this segment will also prosper becomes a no-brainer. Well-managed companies that run nursing homes and elder care services will see their stocks rise. Be careful about what healthcare firms you select, because this sector can include stocks that are defensive and also some that are cyclical. Companies that sell expensive equipment, such as CAT scans or MRI technology, may not do that well in an economic downturn because hospitals and other healthcare facilities may not want to upgrade or replace their equipment. Therefore, healthcare companies that sell big-ticket items can be considered cyclical. On the other hand, companies that sell medicine, pharmaceuticals, can be considered defensive. People who need medicine, such as aspirin or antacids, will buy it no matter how bad the economy is. In fact, people will probably buy even more aspirin and antacids in bad economic times. Also, be wary of political trends as they affect healthcare. America may be slowly lurching toward socialized medicine. If this possibility develops, then turn your bullish expectations into bearish ones. History, and my experience, tells me that a government takeover of an industry like healthcare spells danger for investors, and patients too. Stocks are versatile, in that you can even make money when they go down in value. Techniques range from using put options to going short or doing a short sale of stock. For traditional investors, the more appropriate strategy is first and foremost to avoid or minimize losses. Making money betting that a stock will fall is closer to speculating than actual investing. So all I want is that investors see the pitfalls and act accordingly. Real estate investing has been all the rage in recent years. As I do my seminars across the country, I see the adult education programs top-heavy in real estate courses. How to get rich in real estate. Buy real estate with no money down. But I think real estate meets Frankenstein is more like it. In the old days, when asked the question about how to be successful investing in real estate, the answer was always location, location, location. In this decade, that answer has morphed into credit, 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 which, if you're not careful, is really debt, debt, debt. You come to see that the housing bubble isn't really a problem. It's a symptom. If it is a symptom, then what is the problem? The problem with real estate in recent years has really been too much debt, very lax lending standards, and rampant speculation. By the second quarter of 2005, the data clearly shows a real estate market that's overheated, overpriced, seriously imbalanced, and plainly unsustainable. Most mortgages issued have been either adjustable rate mortgages, ARMs, interest-only mortgages, or negative amortization mortgages. In the latter two mortgages, buyers only pay interest and put no dent into the principal. In addition, many of these mortgages are being issued to buyers who are subprime, which means that their credit is less than strong, so to speak. These people have purchased a house and used creative financing to lower the monthly payment. When interest rates and other costs, such as real estate taxes, rise, millions of overburdened property owners will have financial problems, and this will have a negative effect on the overall economy. On top of that, many of these mortgages are issued at 100% of the property's market value. When you add up these troublesome mortgages, they easily exceed $2 trillion. The value of all mortgages now exceeds 80% of the value of America's GDP. Some analysts will tell you that this isn't a problem because the economy is strong and job growth is good. What they don't see is that during 2004 to 2005, the economy's GDP expanded, primarily due to real estate. And real estate and related industries accounted for 43% of the jobs created since 2001. As housing and construction begin to decline due to overbuilding, more supply, and fewer buyers, lower demand, that means a shrinking real estate market and fewer jobs. As the housing market gets into trouble, this will harm the economy. As the robot on the old TV show Lost in Space used to say, "Warning, Will Robinson, danger, danger." What should stock investors be looking at? The most obvious thing to look at is housing stocks. The stock market tends to be a leading indicator of how well or how poorly the economy is doing. Frequently, subsections of the stock market give you clues about a particular industry. Housing stocks, as of August 2005, have come down substantially from their highs in July 2005. Among the first things I ask myself about the direction of an industry is, how are insiders behaving in the main companies of that industry? During 2000 to 2005, as real estate was on a blazing hot streak, the home building stocks were also very bullish. A good example was Toll Brothers, TOL. That stock was on a meteoric rise during the 12-month period ending in mid-2005. From July to July, it went from $20, price adjusted for split, to $57, a gain of 185%. Guess what? In July 05, most of the insiders sold their stock. By August 2005, the stock was already down more than 20%. Coincidence? I think not. Home builders are among the first to see what's going on in their industry. Similar events occurred at other companies in the industry. The industry has probably hit its peak, and sales will soften. Saying that its torrid pace is over is probably safe. What's a stock investor to do? First of all, be safe. Minimize exposure to this vulnerable sector. I'm not just talking about real estate directly, but also indirectly. Companies and industries that are reliant on the housing sector are also at risk, such as some financial institutions, suppliers, and so on. For those of you who are aggressive, bearish strategies, like going short, or even better, buying put options, are a good speculation. To find out more about what's going on with this historic and gigantic housing bubble, check out some great websites, such as www.housingbubble.blogspot.com and www.realestatebubble.net. I just want to reiterate some points that apply here. I don't presume that stocks go straight up or that they zigzag upward indefinitely. Your due diligence is necessary for your success. Make sure that you're investing appropriately for your situation. If you're 35 and heading into your peak earnings years and want to ride a home run stock and you understand the risks, then go ahead and speculate with that small cap gold mining stock or the solar power technology junior stock. But if you're more risk adverse or your situation is screaming out loud for you to be conservative, then don't speculate. Go instead with a more diversified portfolio of large cap stocks or get the ETF for that particular sector. For those people who want to make money by going short in those sectors that look bearish, again, take a deep breath and remember what's appropriate. Conservative investors will simply avoid the risky areas. Aggressive investors or speculators may want to deploy profitable bearish strategies with a portion of their investable funds. Here are some highlights for all of you. After you choose a promising sector, just select large cap companies that are financially strong, are earning a profit, have low debt, and are market leaders. Being conservative and bullish is proper when you're in or near retirement, have a family to support, or live in a very large shoe with so many kids that you don't know what to do. If you're aggressive and bullish, you want to buy the stocks directly. For real growth potential, look at mid-caps or small-caps. Remember that you're speculating, so you understand the downside risk, but are willing to tolerate the risk because the upside potential can reward you so handsomely. Few things in the investment world give you a better gain than a supercharged stock in a hot sector. For many, if not most, investors, making money on a falling market isn't generally a good idea. Doing so takes a lot of expertise and risk tolerance. Really, for conservative investors, the key word is safety. Analyze your portfolio with an advisor you trust and sell the potentially troubled stocks. If you're not sure what to do on a particular stock, then, at the very least, put in stop-loss orders and make them GTC, good till canceled. As odd as it sounds, sometimes losing less than others makes you come out ahead if you play it right. Because so much economic data is available, many investors prefer to look at indexes that put the data in a nutshell. Indexes try to summarize many economic indicators and put them into a neat, digestible format. Economic indicators are grouped into categories that try to give a rough idea about the economy's upward and downward cycle. These cyclical indicators are put in three categories that try to time the various phases of the economy's movement. Leading. The leading indicators try to be predictive of the economy's path. Stock investors are particularly interested in leading economic indicators because stock investors usually don't invest because of past or present conditions. Investors buy stocks because of expectations for the future. Coincident. The coincident indicators essentially tell you where the economy is right now. For stock investors, most coincident indicators are like the indicator on your car's dashboard blinking hot when you see steam rising from your hood. The most valuable coincident indicator is the gross domestic product, GDP. Lagging. This type of indicator tells you what just passed in the economy's path, which can be significant because some lagging indicators do precede leading indicators. The unemployment rate is a good example of a lagging indicator. Of the three categories, the most widely followed is the Index of Leading Economic Indicators, LEI. A good example of an indicator that's included in the LEI is the statistic on new construction. If more new construction is being started, that's a positive harbinger of economic growth. The Conference Board, www.conferenceboard.org, compiles the LEI monthly. Excellent sources are available that make the arcane world of economics more readable and understandable. One is the American Institute for Economic Research, AIER, a nonprofit organization that offers excellent information for beginners on economics and markets. AIER offers a booklet called Forecasting Business Trends that gives investors some clear yet detailed explanations and insights on the business cycle. Another source with excellent essays and easy-to-read analysis is the Ludwig von Mises Institute at www.mises.org. By the way, as you navigate the world of economics, you'll come across various schools of thought. The most well-known is the Keynesian school, and the most problematic is the Marx school. By the way, Groucho knows more than Karl. In my opinion and experience, the best is the Austrian school of economics. Mises is considered the dean of this school. Austrian economists have been the most accurate in interpreting and forecasting economic events. Among the events they warned about were the Great Depression, the collapse of communism, and the dangers of America's current mammoth debt bubble. Understanding the general markets and their major directional trend may even be more important to your wealth-building success than choosing the right stock. Recent years and a century of stock market history bear, no pun intended, witness to this point. Bull and bear markets have a tremendous effect on your stock choices. Generally, bull markets tend to precede economic uptrends, also called economic rebound, economic recovery, or economic growth, while bear markets tend to precede economic downtrends, also called recession, depression, or economic contraction. The stock market's movement is based on the fact that stock prices go up or down based on people's buying or selling behavior. If more people are buying stock versus selling, then stock prices rise. If more people are selling stocks, then stock prices fall. Why do people buy or sell a stock? It can be explained in one word, expectations. People generally buy or sell stock in expectation of economic events. If they feel that times are getting bad and the economic stats back them up in the form of rising unemployment, shrinking corporate profits, cutbacks in consumer spending, and so on, then they become more cautious, which can have a couple of results. They sell stock that they currently own. They don't buy stock because they feel that stocks won't do well. Of course, when the economy is doing well, the reverse is true. In the beginning, a bull market doesn't look like a bull market at all. It looks like anything but. Maybe that's why so few catch on early. Bull markets are marked by great optimism as the economy roars forward and stocks go skyward. Everyone knows what a bull market should look like, and everyone can recognize it when it's become a mature trend. The saying, "I don't know what it is, but I'll know it when I see it," is one that applies to a bull market. But if you can foresee it coming, you may be able to make a fortune by getting in just before the crowd sees it. Just keep in